This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Bidjigal people of the Eora Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional custodians of this land.
Merdeka! Merdeka! Merdeka!
The country of Indonesia.
Do they like me in Indonesia?
100% confident Indonesia will prevail.
Hello and welcome to Talking Indonesia. My name is Elizabeth Kramer from the University of New South Wales and I'm your podcast host for today. This episode we're talking about religious minorities and human rights in Indonesia. The vast majority of Indonesians are Sunni Muslims and there has always been tension between politicized Islam, that is, the Islam of the majority, and the secular state. This has had implications for how religious minorities are treated in Indonesia, both under the law and outside of the law. Looking at the experiences of religious minorities, both Islamic minorities and other religions, can tell us a lot about the state of human rights in Indonesia and how broadly human rights are applied. My guest today is Dr. Al-Khanif, who has done extensive research into this topic, especially in terms of international human rights and Indonesia's constitution. His research spotlights constitutional and jural traditions being the unwritten rules or legal norms that have developed over time, sometimes under legal influence and sometimes outside of it. He's the author of the book, Religious Minorities, Islam and the Law, International Human Rights and Islamic Law in Indonesia, which came out with Routledge in 2020. And he holds a PhD in law from the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, at the University of London. He was the chairperson of the Indonesian Consortium for Human Rights Lecturers, SIPAHAM, between 2017 and 2019. And he currently hails from the University of Jember, where he is the head of the Center for Human Rights, Multiculturalism and Migration. Hi, Dr. Al-Khanif. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Talking Indonesia podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Dr. Elizabeth. It is my pleasure and my honor to join in your podcast.
Well, thank you so much. So I want to jump straight into the questions that I've got here for you. Today we're talking about religious minorities and human rights. So this is one of your main areas of research. I want to start by asking you, when you talk about religious minorities in Indonesia, who are you actually talking about? Who are the religious minorities that your research is focused on?
When I'm talking about minorities focused on the religious minorities within a certain religion. And if I may more specifics with these minorities, my focus is on the minorities within Islam, because I think there are not many previous research on this issue. But the realities of religious minorities within Islam in Indonesia must be discussed academically, because they live in Muslim majority communities where many of these communities much rely on a legal tradition rather than relying on the constitution and also international human rights instrument. So this is what I'm talking about, minorities in Indonesia.
And maybe it might be helpful, because some of our listeners might not have a good background on the spectrum of Islam in Indonesia. So what kinds of religious beliefs do these minorities have that make them different from, say, mainstream Muslims in the country?
We have some different kind of Sunnis in the Muslim world, but in Indonesia mostly are Shafi'i, Sunni majorities. I think they occupy more or less 80% of the, maybe 90% of the total population of Muslim in Indonesia. But only a few Muslim in Indonesia do not belong to the Sunnis. They belong to Shiite, for example, and also some other Sunni minorities such as Ahmadis, and also we have some other Sunni Muslims in Indonesia which belong to minorities like LDII. LDII stand for the Indonesian Islamic Preaching Community Groups, which mainly they are based in East Java, Indonesia. So the main difference between these Muslim minorities and Muslim majorities is in terms of the school of law.
Right. So in terms of the way that they practice Islam and their beliefs around different laws within Islam, there are differences within the communities.
Yes. And as if I may add something, that because Shiites, they also live mainly in East Java, in Madura Island, where the majority is Muslim, and also they are majority Sunnis. Only 100 or maybe 200 families belong to the Shiites, and they must live under the majority rules of Sunni Shafi'i Muslim. So this is what I am researching about.
And when you're looking at these specific religious minorities, what kinds of challenges do you see in your research? What are the main issues that they face, particularly in terms of human rights and freedom of religion?
Yeah. Thank you very much for this question. It is very common question, but I think the answer will be different and will be never-ending answer. The main challenge is that the Indonesian government enacted the blasphemy law since 1965, and it was amended and revised. And now focus and scope is much broader than the blasphemy law in the 1965 version. In the new Indonesian criminal law, the term blasphemy fall within six different articles in the Indonesian new criminal law, which I think previously, because now the draft is still not active, so we still have the blasphemy law in the version of 1965, where in many cases, in many incidents, this blasphemy law targeted the non-mainstream Islamic interpretations, not only Islam, I think, in the history of the application of blasphemy law, there are some minorities within a certain religion, like a Christian. We also have some cases like in East Nusa Tenggara, in Bandung, they are also targeted by this blasphemy law. So the main challenge, I think, for religious minorities in Indonesia is that the blasphemy law is actually designed by Sukarno at the time to restrict or ban misleading religious interpretation. But in reality, the application of blasphemy law is targeting many non-mainstream religious interpretation. In Islam, they targeted Shiites and also Ahmadis, for example, because based on this blasphemy law, the Indonesian Council of Ulama, Indonesian Ulama Council in 2005, before, I think, they enacted two fatwas. The first is in 1982, and it was revised in 2005, which this fatwa primarily said that Ahmadis is not Islam. So it was followed by many incidents at the time. And also Shiite in East Java, for example, the Indonesian Ulama Council of East Java Province enacted a fatwa which declared that Shiite is not Muslim. And after that, it was followed by many incidents, persecution against Shiites and Ahmadis.
I think, again, because maybe some of our listeners aren't overly familiar with what's happening with religious minorities and particularly how the blasphemy law is being implemented, it might be useful to give some concrete examples of cases where the blasphemy law has been used against religious minorities. Maybe you can share some from your research.
Yeah, there are, I think, tens of cases brought before the court and also settled by the consensus or oral tradition in society. One most current blasphemy law case is Meliana Tan. She was Buddhist from North Sumatra. She was charged by using blasphemy law because she protests against the loudspeaker of mosque where they use as for prayer or azan at the time. So blasphemy law in reality or in the implementation can target inter-religious minorities like non-Muslim in majority Muslim communities. If we want to see the case within Muslim majorities, we also can see, for example, the case of Tajul Muluk, the leader of Shiites in Sampang, Madura in 2012, and also Ahmadis in Chikasi, West Java in 2011, where these two cases were charged using blasphemy law because the Shiites and Ahmadis were charged because their members blaspheming Islam based on their Islamic interpretation.
And this question is a little bit off script, but are there any cases where somebody from the Muslim majority have been charged under the blasphemy law that you know of? Or has the law only been used in cases that are related to people who are from minority religions or subsets of Islam?
Well, there are some very old, I think one old case, it was in 1982, I forgot, in Situbondo, East Java, where Muhammad Saleh belonged to the Sunni Muslim majority. So yeah, he was part of the majority. But he was charged 5 years in prison because he spoke to some of his friends, said that the late Asad Samsul Arifin, the prominent figure of the NU Muslim leader from the Situbondo, said that Asad Samsul Arifin is not perfect as human being. For me, this argument is absolutely correct, 100% correct, because in Muslim tradition or in Islamic teaching, there is no perfect human being. Only Muhammad is the perfect one. So he spoke that Asad Samsul Arifin is not perfect, is not perfect human, but then many of his followers, the Kiai Haji Asad Samsul Arifin's follower, was really angry with the argument of Muhammad Saleh, and he was prosecuted. At the time, there was a very chaotic event because some people said that Muhammad Saleh was hiding by the church official, so there were some church were burned by the mass, and after that, then Muhammad Saleh was charged by the police and sent to prison 5 years. But it was very rare. So blasphemy in Islamic law, we have blasphemy, but I think the specific dimension of blasphemy is very, very narrow. But in application, it can target everyone, not only about Islamic teaching, but also from their sentiment, from their argument, from their, even from their research base. If we see, if we know, Arswendo Atmowiloto, the editor of the Monitor magazine, so he was charged using blasphemy law in 1982 based on his interview and questionnaire to the reader of Monitor magazine. And the question is, who do you think the most influential human being? And at the time, in 1982, Muhammad was, I think, on the 9 or maybe 11 list rank. So
oh, he was ranked. So it was a ranking, and the Prophet, yeah, Muhammad was
on the 9 or 11. And
not number one.
Not number one. Then, yeah, Aswendo Atmowiloto was charged using blasphemy, and then he was sent to prison 5 years.
Right. So it sounds like in the application of the blasphemy law, there's a lot of nuanced, perhaps personal vendettas or grudges mm-hmm. that come mm-hmm. up in its application, and it's quite politicized rather than being yes. a pure application of the law, if such a thing exists. Yeah. But that actually leads nicely into my next question about the legal issues related to religious minorities. So it sounds like the blasphemy law is a particular example of a law that has had a huge impact on religious minorities. But what legal rights and protections do they actually have, especially under the Indonesian constitution?
Well, if we put, for example, the first pillar of Pancasila correctly, belief in one supreme God, we should say that the Indonesian law protect equally religious minorities. But I think the most common application of the first pillar of Pancasila is that God is divine theologically, not sociologically. Because I think if we interpret God and religion theologically, what comes after this interpretation is the manipulation of religion, the manipulation of God by the majorities, while in Indonesia as a state which doesn't recognize a certain religion as the supreme source of law or as perhaps the supreme law of the land, we cannot interpret these two legal canopies in Pancasila and in the Indonesian constitution theologically, because then if we see them as a theological consensus or maybe theological political consensus among the majorities, then I think we will see minorities is excluded from the protection of in the constitution and also in Pancasila. This is, I think, what I believe that the legal issues of minorities in Indonesia is that they are actually protected, but the many incidents toward the religious minorities indicate that they are not equally protected.
So your research spotlights constitutional and jural tradition, and jural tradition is sort of the unwritten rules or legal norms that have developed over time. You've just talked about how within Pancasila it can be interpreted as a general protection for people who hold specific religious beliefs, as long as they believe theologically in the divinity of a God. But on the other hand, in its application, it hasn't been equal. So how has the jural tradition over time and the norms that have developed played out in Indonesia? And what role has, I guess, majority Islam played in influencing the way that minority religions are treated?
I think my main concern when I want to connect between the constitutional clause of religious values in Indonesian constitution and jural tradition, many comments, mainly from human rights activists and also some report from the NGOs, say that police are the one who get involved in the persecutions of minorities, and also the police is involved in the violation of human rights, mainly on religious minorities. I want to see whether there is a mechanism or maybe legal mechanism that is hidden from their observation. And I want to dig deep into this mechanism to see whether is there any kind of legal mechanism that was practiced and also implemented by communities. But from the outsider, they do not know that actually the communities already use their legal mechanism to resolve this problem. Then it comes to my hypothesis that in Indonesia, there are two kinds of laws. The first is law made by the state. It is in a written document from the constitution until perda or bylaws. And the second one is that the law recognized by the state, but it is unwritten, but it is practiced by many communities, societies, in a very long development of this tradition. When I come to this hypothesis, I see in some documentation from the court, for example, like in Tajul Muluk Syed Sampang in 2012, and also Ahmadi's case in Chikasik, West Java. So in the court hearing, in the document, it is written clearly that before the case brought before the court, the local government already held several meetings, discussion between the majorities and the minorities to settle the issue, the conflicts. But after, for example, like in Sampang, East Java, it is written in the document that there were several times from the consensus that initiated by the local government, but it failed to prevent the conflicts. When there was a conflict a breakout in 2012, so the court believed that it is because Tajul Muluk and Shiites, which was recommended to stop their preaching, but they still keep doing it. So the court actually just to legitimize the process of jural tradition. Well, for me, jural tradition must be recognized by the state, but in this case, what is missing is that jural traditions or the members of communities who are involved in this jural tradition, they do not know about human rights. They are not perhaps in a very long period of time after Reformasi or maybe before Reformasi, they just develop their own understanding about law, about tradition, but they do not know anything about human rights, in particular religious freedom. So they try to find their way to set up the decision based on the jural tradition. And then what we see right now is that many of them, they believe that minorities is preaching collective consensus. It is a very short explanation. So it is very common then, for example, like Tajul Muluk was recommended to have two choices. The first is come back to Sunni Muslim and then you live here peacefully, or you still preach Shiite Muslim, you have to get out from this community. I think this is kind of a sanction, or maybe jural sanction. And then it was legitimized by the court, or maybe the official court of Sampang and also East Java province.
And so just to clarify with that particular example, so because he didn't take either of the options that were presented to him within the mediation, so was it the local government that was providing the mediation? Okay, so he was given the option of either changing his religious beliefs to fit with the Sunni majority or leaving the community altogether, and he chose not to do either of those. And then when that choice became clear, that's when the official legal sanctions were brought against him. Do I have that right?
I think so, yes. So that's why I think official court is just legitimized the sanction from the jural community.
Right, which is an interesting way of doing things if you think about just in general the concept of rule of law and application, equal application of laws to all citizens. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there is some gray areas within your research that are really highlighting how minorities are particularly impacted by not just the official law, but also the jural traditions that exist, and also individual interpretations of what is correct and right,
yes,
which might not actually take into account human rights.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that, yeah, am I understanding?
Yeah.
I think my next question is, all right, so you've explained some of the problems or issues. What do you think can be done to improve the protections for religious minorities in Indonesia?
I think the Indonesian government already had really good start to make some progress in protecting religious minorities. It started when Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono was in office. I think it was in 2005 or maybe 2006. I read the Human Rights Action Plan enacted by President SBY, which target local communities as the main actor that must be educated. But unfortunately, this National Human Rights Action Plan didn't work properly, just in written in the paper.
Mm. Often it's the implementation that's the exactly. issue, isn't it?
So that's why I think the gap between much bigger right now, because after Reformasi, some traditionalists, they become more radicals, they have more power to speak out about their rights, but then they are not part of the Human Rights Action Plan. And we still focus on developing law made by the state or written documents. But for me, I think it should be enough to Indonesia to have a human rights law enacted in 1999. And then we also have some sectoral laws which specifically protect and also promote human rights. But without considering community members, especially someone who has authority in their community, I think it will be really big mistake for the Indonesian human rights development in the future. So we must put them as a main actor or maybe main object or maybe subject of the human rights promotion in Indonesia, because I do believe that we still have many more cases brought before the jural traditions in some local contexts.
And what you're saying is that if human rights frameworks and considerations are brought in at the local level, then that might stop these cases from getting to criminal prosecutions or situations where particular minority groups or individuals from these groups are actually being, you know, sentenced to jail time or quite serious criminal sanctions for issues that really are about freedom of expression and freedom of religion.
Yeah. I think based on my observations, if there is a case on blaspheming religion, once it was brought before the court, I think it will be really difficult for us to advocate the case. Usually the victim or maybe the actor of the somebody who are accused of blaspheming religion will be sentenced to prison. So I think we must start from very early or maybe in the beginning of the process, and we must educate not only society, but I think local community leaders or maybe local religious leaders who usually they have authority not only to help the jural tradition, but also to influence their community members.
All right. I want to ask you one final question, which is looking into the future with your crystal ball. As we all know, there's recently been an election in Indonesia, and it looks like we know who the new president will be after Jokowi's term is finished later this year. And we also roughly know which political parties are going to have power and authority in the DPR. So do you foresee the upcoming changes in the presidency or in the DPR as having any impact on the rights of religious minorities? Or do you think it'll just be the same?
Okay. I am very naive in politics, but let me try to answer this question. My prediction will be minorities will not be put as a priority policies from our next government. And I think the parliament will also still remain the same as before, because now we are still revising the new Indonesian criminal law, and the six articles which fall within blasphemy law will not be amended. Nobody in the parliament will talk about the revision or maybe the deletion of the blasphemy law. So I do believe that the minorities will be still in a very low level of priority. One of my best example of the president in Indonesia must be President Wahid. Everyone will acknowledge that during the Wahid presidency, minorities were very happy because they are put equally and also they are protected equally with the majorities. But after President Wahid, I think the situation of minorities becoming really worse. I think the worst realities of minorities was during the 10 years of SPY presidency, where we had so many cases at the time. But during the Jokowi era, we didn't have many cases, like in the surface. But I think in local context, I think we still have many because we have Jural traditions, which mostly believe that somebody who has different interpretation of religion is again a collective interpretation of religion and also consensus within the community. This is my prediction. It could be wrong. I hope that my prediction will be wrong, and I hope that the minorities will be treated equally.
Better than they are at the moment, yeah. But equal to everybody else in Indonesia, yes. I guess. And I think, too, your final comment speaks to the importance of your work and the work of human rights advocates in Indonesia who might have a bit of a difficult journey ahead of them. We shall see. Mm-hmm. But the need for advocacy and to make sure that information about human rights is being shared throughout the Indonesian community, especially at the local level, is really important at this point in time to make sure that people from minority religions are receiving the same rights as everybody else in Indonesia.
I hope so.
So with that, I want to say thank you for your time, Dr. Hanif. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. I hope to see you in person again soon. But thank you very much for joining me on this edition of Talking Indonesia podcast.
Thank you very much. See you soon in Indonesia.
I'll see you in Jember.
Okay. Sure.
And that's it from me today on Talking Indonesia podcast. You can find us on all of your favorite podcast channels, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and others. Please do give us a like and a follow in order to receive the latest episode of Talking Indonesia in your app. With that, thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Talking Indonesia.